Okay, I'd like to tell you about some work I did recently with my postdoc, Kengo Maeda. It appeared on the net about a month ago. I must say I was stunned when we obtained these results. Something that I thought was true for almost 10 years turns out not to be true. And this concerns an instability of black strings and black pea brains. As I'm sure you're all aware, ordinary black holes are stable. If you perturb the Schwarzschild solution, you find that the perturbation remains small. In fact, the perturbation either radiates off to infinity or falls down the horizon and in fact decays at a certain characteristic rate, which you can calculate and is related to something called quasi-normal modes. But in string theory, we're interested in higher dimensional generalizations of black holes, such as black strings and pea brains. And it turns out that some of these extended black holes are unstable. And this is something which was first discovered by Gregory and Laflamme back in 1993. So the simplest example is just a four-dimensional Schwarzschild solution across a circle. This solution is characterized by two parameters, the Schwarzschild radius R0 and the length of the circle L. This is, of course, the solution to just the five-dimensional vacuum Einstein equation. And if you now perturb this equation and study the linearized perturbations, you find that there are modes which grow exponentially in time. The modes which do this are, or can be chosen to be, spherically symmetric. And they have a wavelength lambda along the circle which is larger than the Schwarzschild radius R0. And what this instability looks like in terms of the horizon geometry is that you take the original sort of translationally invariant horizon, and it turns into this wiggly horizon in which it looks like the horizon is starting to pinch off at certain places. Well, since you get these unstable modes only when the wavelength along the circle is larger than the Schwarzschild radius, the original black string is unstable provided L is bigger than R0. Otherwise, you just don't have any long wavelength perturbations to start with. Gregory and Laflamme not only did this linearized analysis, they also compared the entropy of the original black string with the entropy of a single black hole having the same total mass, and found that the entropy of the black hole was much bigger in general than the entropy of the black string. So they then said that it was likely that in the full nonlinear evolution, the black string would break up into black holes, and then the black holes would coalesce. So you'd expect the final state to be a single black hole, which would then have this maximum entropy. Of course, classically, it's well known that horizons cannot bifurcate. So what people expected was that the original translationally invariant black string, under ordinary classical evolution, would pinch off in this way. Now, there's a singularity running down the center of this black string. So at these points where the horizon approaches the zero size, the curvature becomes very large. And because of that, it's quite plausible that quantum effects would then become important and cause the horizon to actually bifurcate, and you form these separate black holes. Well, this idea that black strings will evolve into a black hole has been widely accepted and has in fact been used in many recent string discussions. For example, in discussions several years ago on black holes and matrix theory, in discussions more recently of the density of states in strongly coupled conformal field theories via the ADS-CFT correspondence, in the relation between near extremal D2 and M2 brains, in discussions of black holes on brain worlds, and very recently in some analogous, well, discussions of unstable D0 brain configurations. All of these discussions have used this fact that black strings, at least with L bigger than R naught, are unstable and will break up into black holes. What I'd like to do today is to try to convince you that that simply doesn't happen. Black strings do not break up into black holes. Instead, they settle down to new black string solutions, which are static, but simply not translationally invariant along the string. And in the final static configuration, the horizon might look something like this, where you simply have a wiggly oscillating horizon, and the solution is stable, but it's not translationally invariant. And this is very much like spontaneous symmetry breaking. In fact, it's an example of spontaneous symmetry breaking in general relativity, where the maximally symmetric solution, the translationally invariant one, is unstable, and the stable solution has less symmetry than the one you started with. Now, how am I going to convince you of this? Well, I'll first present a proof that horizons can simply not pinch off in finite time. Under classical evolution, horizons cannot pinch off in finite time. I'll then give two arguments that it's very unlikely that the horizons cannot pinch off in infinite time. If they could pinch off in infinite time, then you might argue that the curvature will eventually become large enough that quantum effects will become important and the horizon could bifurcate. But we haven't been able to rigorously rule out this possibility. But as I said, I will present two arguments that make it seem very unlikely that that's the way out. These arguments are very general and in fact apply to all of the unstable p-brain configurations, even those with charge as well as the ones without charge. But for simplicity, I'll focus on the simplest case here. So let's start with this four-dimensional Schwarzschild metric plus a spherical perturbation. This is a five-dimensional space-time. And okay, we're going to take a spherical perturbation, we're going to evolve it under the full five-dimensional vacuum Einstein equations and ask what happens to the horizon. Well, we know a lot of things about the horizon. We know that it's a null surface, and so in particular, it must have null geodesics running along it. So let lambda be the affine parameter along the null geodesic generators of the event horizon. So then let's look at a particular cross-section of the horizon, and the geometry on this cross-section can be written like this. It's spherically symmetric. So we have e to the 2 chi dz squared plus e to the 2 psi d omega, where z is a coordinate along the s1 direction. So that's the extra direction that we've added. And chi and psi are two metric functions which can depend on z and lambda. Lambda should be thought of as time running along the event horizon. If the horizon is going to pinch off, then this function psi has to go to minus infinity. So that means the area of the spheres is going to zero. So let's look at the tangent vector L to these null geodesic generators of the event horizon. So that's just d by d lambda. And let's consider the divergence of this family of null geodesic generators. So that divergence is usually called theta. Theta, the divergence of L, is given by the usual formula, 1 over the square root of the determinant g, d by d lambda, root g. And just by multiplying by root g and integrating, you see immediately that the integral of theta is a measure of the rate of change of the area of the event horizon. Now, it's a fundamental property of event horizons that theta cannot be negative. This, in fact, is the basis of Hawking's famous area theorem, which says that the area of an event horizon cannot decrease. But it's important to note that the area theorem actually comes from a more powerful and local statement, which is just the statement that theta, the divergence of these null geodesics on the event horizon, cannot be negative. So now we're going to look at the rate of change of theta as we move along the geodesic. The change in theta is given by something called the Reichardt-Hurry equation. This plays a fundamental role in all the singularity theorems in general relativity. The Reichardt-Hurry equation is given here. It says that the change in theta as you move along the geodesics is equal to minus theta squared over 3. Well, that's it over 3. Well, that's certainly a negative quantity. Minus something sigma mu nu squared, which is a square of the shear of this null geodesic congruence. The shear is a measure of how a family of null geodesics gets distorted as you move along it, how the shape changes. And minus the Ricci tensor contracted twice with the null geodesic generators. Well, we're considering a vacuum solution here, so the Ricci tensor is zero, and the square of the shear, the square of the shear by itself, is turns out to be positive definite. This is, therefore, again, negative definite. And with the ansatz for the geometry on the horizon, you can compute this and find that d theta d lambda is less than or equal to minus d psi d lambda squared. So now, if the horizon is going to pinch off in finite time, psi must go to minus infinity in finite lambda. That means that the derivative of psi with respect to lambda is also diverging. And it's easy to see that the square of the derivative of psi cannot be integrable if psi itself is going to minus infinity. And therefore, theta cannot stay positive. And in fact, if psi tries to go to minus infinity, theta itself goes to minus infinity, and you get a contradiction. So this proves that the horizon can simply not pinch off in finite time. And you see that the argument is really quite simple. It's just saying that if we were given that the divergence of the horizon generators must be positive, if a two-sphere tries to shrink off, to shrink down to zero size, the only way that can happen is if the horizon is expanding very rapidly in the circle direction. But if the horizon is expanding rapidly in the circle direction, at the same time it's shrinking in the sphere direction, that produces an enormous amount of shear. It's changing the shape very rapidly. That also comes in causing the divergence to decrease, and you get a contradiction. So what about the possibility that the horizon pinches off in infinite time? Well, I said I'd give you two arguments for this since I don't have a rigorous proof. So the first argument asks, how can the horizon pinch off in infinite time? Well, one way that might happen is if the horizon forms this long neck and looks something like this. So let's consider a surface that runs down in the middle of this long neck and call that z equal to 0. Well, I claim that this, we can rigorously show that this type of pinching off cannot happen. It already looks very unlikely because this long neck is exactly the sort of thing which we know is unstable to linearized perturbations. So you wouldn't expect a solution at late times to be approaching an unstable configuration. So that already tells you that this is pretty unlikely. But in fact, you can rigorously rule it out by looking at the induced Einstein equation on this z equals 0 surface. By using a type of Kaluza-Klein reduction, the equations here look like a four-dimensional general relativity coupled to an additional scalar field, which is just sort of this GZZ component of the metric. You have a space-time which describes a spherical black hole with some dynamical field, and it's easy to show that the evolution that would correspond to the horizon pinching off in infinite time is just completely inconsistent with what we know happens when spherical black holes interact with scalar fields in four dimensions. So this cannot happen. The other possibility is that the horizon will try to form a short neck. In other words, it will pinch off in such a way that looks like two big spherical black holes just touching with some small little neck. But now you can argue that in a neighborhood of, say, a point P, which is right near this neck, the space-time should look like these two spherical black holes. But we know from studies of black hole collisions what happens when you bring two big spherical black holes very close together. And what happens is not that you form a horizon which looks like this, but instead, if you have, say, apparent horizons which surround each of the two black holes, you always form another apparent horizon which basically just encloses both black holes, and the true event horizon is outside of that. So the true event horizon never pinches off, and the reason is clear. This is really just saying that you have twice as much mass inside a sphere enclosing both black holes, and so the natural Schwarzschild radius is going to jump out and be twice as big, and the horizon just doesn't pinch off like that. So what we expect is not that the horizon would do this, but in fact would just stay outside. So that's the first argument, that there just doesn't seem to be any way of the horizon pinching off, any plausible way of the horizon pinching off even in infinite time. There's a second argument which asks about the rate at which the horizon could pinch off if it tries to do so at infinite time. The rate is highly restricted because remember we saw that the derivative of the area, the rate of change of the area, is given by theta. We know that at late times the area had better stay finite and not become infinite, and that tells you something, another restriction on theta, basically that the integral of theta along the null geodesic generators has to be finite. That translates back into a statement about how quickly the spheres could pinch off, and the type of decay which is not obviously ruled out. You can easily rule out simple exponential decays, power law decays, anything like that. The type of thing which is not obviously ruled out is something like this, where the minimum area sphere goes like e to the minus log of the affine parameter to a power which is between 0 and 1/2. This is a very, very slow decay. And in fact, at late times, the solution is essentially static. You can think of the late time evolution, if this was happening, as really just motion, very slow motion, in a series of static solutions, because the geometry just doesn't change. But once you're led to postulate new static solutions, it seems much more plausible that the evolution just stops at one of these static solutions and does not continue pinching off at this very, very slow rate.
What is the difficult case? So if it's the case of if this is what is really happening, then if you wait very long enough, then the horizon size eventually becomes unstable.
Sure. Sure. So if this is really what happens and you wait long enough, then the horizon will eventually become Planck scale. That's why I don't have a rigorous proof. Okay. What I'm saying is it seems to us that this is, first of all, rather unnatural to find in an evolution. And it's so slow that there's, well, it seems to be much slower than any other time scale that you could imagine the problem, so that you would have to expect that there is some static solution which is around, and you're simply moving very slowly through a sort of moduli space of static solutions. That's the picture. But okay, so now let me, after I hopefully have convinced you that that's unlikely, let's now consider the much more likely possibility that the space-time actually does settle down to a new static but not translationally invariant black string solution. We don't have the exact solution explicitly, but nevertheless, you can say something about the expected properties it will have. If you start with a black string, which is very long and narrow, so L is much bigger than the initial Schwarzschild radius, it seems likely that the final configuration will be determined by just one parameter, which is the Schwarzschild radius itself. That's because the sort of the boundary between unstable and stable modes is set by R0. And if the solution is essentially determined by just one parameter, you would expect that the maximum area of the sphere on the horizon divided by the minimum area of the sphere is a number of order unity. In other words, the maximum area of the sphere is maybe twice the initial Schwarzschild radius. The minimum is maybe half the Schwarzschild radius. But you don't expect a large dimensionless number to arise in the final configuration of this solution. And so we expect this thing not to be huge, but numbers of order unity. You also know that the new solution will approach the translationally invariant solution asymptotically, because the effect of all the wiggles will die off. And you furthermore know that it will approach the translationally invariant solution exponentially fast. And that's just because that any z, at infinity, the solution will be some perturbation of the translationally invariant solution. And any z-dependent perturbation satisfies a massive spin 2 equation and will die off exponentially. General arguments tell you that the surface gravity of the horizon, and hence the Hawking temperature, is going to be constant on the horizon, even though the geometry is not translationally invariant, not translationally invariant. And there's also a general argument which tells you that the total mass is equal to the surface gravity times the total horizon area divided by 4 pi. This is something which you can show holds for any static vacuum solution in general relativity. So it must be true here as well. Finally, you can argue that the entropy of the new solution will certainly be bigger than the entropy of the original translationally invariant solution. Horizon area increases. But you can also show that the entropy of the new solution will be less than the entropy of a single individual black hole. This does not contradict the fact that the new solution is expected to be stable. There are lots of stable configurations which do not maximize their entropy for the given energy. So we're basically predicting a lot of new solutions to Einstein's equation. And this makes a testable prediction. So you can start with an initial length of the circle at infinity and an initial Schwarzschild radius, or more precisely, this, say, mass per unit length. And for every choice of L and R0, you expect at least one new solution, possibly more than one. And if you vary L, keeping this mass to length ratio fixed, when L becomes very small, smaller than the Schwarzschild radius, the original translationally invariant solution is stable. So in sort of a space of solutions diagram here, the translationally invariant black strings are along the horizontal. This region where L is less than R0 is stable. This region is unstable. We expect a new branch of solutions to come off here, which would then be stable, and then possibly this branches again when L becomes bigger than 2 R0 or something like that. It could keep branching. We're not really sure. But what's definitely predicted here is that you would predict that there should be a perturbation, a non-trivial static perturbation of the Schwarzschild cross S1 solution, which is sort of the first step along this branch of new solutions. Well, that's something you can easily check, and in fact, it has been checked and is known to be true. In fact, this was known to be true back in 1993 when Gregory and Laflamme first did their analysis. So this strongly suggested even then that there was, in fact, a new branch of static solutions which were just not translationally invariant. Well, I've discussed the spherically symmetric five-dimensional case for much of this talk, but I want to emphasize that the arguments actually apply much more generally. Because they're essentially local and are based on fundamental properties of the event horizon, you can generalize them to non-spherical spacetimes, higher dimensional black holes with matter, and even ones with different dimensional cycles trying to shrink down. And one finds this sort of general theorem. Say, consider the event horizon of any space-time satisfying the weak energy condition. So that's the statement that the stress-energy tensor contracted with the tensor contracted with the null generators of the horizon twice is greater than or equal to zero. That's the generalization of the Einstein equation. It's a very weak condition on the matter. You look at the event horizon, and you just take any circle on, say, the event horizon at some time, lambda equals zero. If you just follow that circle along the null generators, you get a family of circles at each affine parameter lambda. And the claim is that the length of these circles cannot shrink to zero in finite affine parameter. That's the generalization that these spheres, two spheres, cannot shrink to zero. Just any circle on the horizon cannot shrink to zero size in finite time. So let me conclude this part of the talk with some final comments. We would, of course, like to find these new solutions explicitly. But various people have tried over the years and have not yet succeeded, which means that finding the new solutions analytically may be hard. Numerical work is certainly possible and is, in fact, already underway. There are a group of people at the University of British Columbia who are numerically integrating this Gregory-Laflamme instability and will hopefully confirm the predictions here. And we should have those results, I don't know, a few months, maybe 6 months, before they get their codes reliable. The implications for string theory remain to be investigated. So let me just go back and quickly remind you there were many contexts where this has been assumed. In some of the cases, not much is going to be changed. For example, in the first discussion of black holes on brain worlds, the argument was that you consider essentially a black string in an ADS space, and they argued that the black string would be unstable, would pinch off, and you would get localized black holes on the brain. There's now many discussions proving directly that you can have localized black holes on brains. You don't need to invoke this sort of breaking off the black string argument. Also, the arguments about unstable D0 brain configurations, well, they're still unstable as D0 brain configurations, and maybe the D0 brains, I mean, this, I should say, is in the context of the Myers effect. You have some background field. You have, say, a cylinder of D0 brains. They're unstable when the length of the cylinder is bigger than the sort of radius, and they want to form spheres, ordinary two spheres, which is the stable configuration that Myers showed. That's all true, of course. It's just not analogous to what happens to black hole horizons. What's perhaps more interesting is, say, this discussion of the relation between near-extremal D2 brains and M2 brains, where it was argued that because the dilaton is becoming very large near the horizon of the D2 brain, you have to go to M theory. And in M theory, you originally have a sort of smeared M2 brain. And then it was argued that it should localize in the 11th direction because of this Gregory-Laflamme instability. And that was supposed to be confirmed. And that was supposed to be confirmed, or at least consistent with the expectation of what happens in the 2+1 conformal field theory as you flow to the infrared. Well, now that we know that these smeared M2 brains simply do not localize, but become wiggly M2 brains, that's a different implication for what happens to the 2+1 conformal field theory, and we need to understand what that is. Okay, well, we were asked by the organizers to speculate about new directions, and I left a lot of time in my talk because I have a lot of speculations. So let me start. Actually, there's two things I'd like to talk about. One is, I think we generally need to understand time dependence in string theory much better. This was Juan's theme, and he actually made progress on some of the things I was going to mention. But I think, nevertheless, we still have a lot we have to understand. Time dependence is, of course, crucial, and a better understanding of it is needed to understand De Sitter space, cosmology in general, the space-time inside black holes, which is what Juan was just explaining to us, and space-like singularities in general, such as the Big Bang. I mean, these are, of course, the most important singularities to understand. These are the ones predicted by the singularity theorems of general relativity. And although we've made great progress in understanding a number of time-like singularities in string theory, we have relatively little understanding of the space-like singularities, a bit more now that Juan has explained the eternal black holes in ADS. Now, most of the discussion of these problems has focused on the deep conceptual issues, like what is the analog of the S matrix, and how do we understand horizons? But I think there's really a much more elementary and basic problem that we have not understood properly. So the more basic problem is the following. Consider a time-dependent, asymptotically flat, and non-singular solution of string theory. There are lots of them. I mean, you can just take, in general relativity, say arbitrary gravitational waves, let them scatter in some nonlinear way under the full nonlinear Einstein equation, and it's known that if the amplitudes are not too large, but certainly, you know, finite, there are no singularities formed. The space-time is completely, it's asymptotically flat and non-singular. And so the question is, what are the quantum string loop corrections to the scattering amplitudes about this background? The S matrix should be well-defined. Space-time is asymptotically flat, not singular. No problems in the space-time. And this is supposed to be a quantum theory of gravity. And you can compute scattering amplitudes, and we should be able to say what the quantum corrections are to those scattering amplitudes in this time-dependent background. And yet, the usual technology that has been developed and has been used for discussing loop amplitudes, all that stuff about Riemann surfaces and moduli spaces, really requires that we analytically continue and deal with Riemannian metrics on the world sheet, Riemannian metrics on space-time, which in turn requires that we have a static space-time, a space-time with a preferred time-like symmetry that we can analytically continue and construct the analogous Euclidean solution. If your space-time is genuinely time-dependent, that technology does not seem to apply. And the question is, how are we going to compute loop corrections? Well, there are a couple of approaches you might think of. One is you might just expand the non-trivial background, the space-time metric, about a flat metric plus corrections, analytically continue in the flat metric, and use the usual stuff. At best, that seems very awkward and unnatural to have to introduce an extra flat metric, take your curve solution and expand in this way. At worst, it may be inconsistent or wrong in the sense that it's known that the light cones of the real space-time are different from the light cones of this fictitious flat metric that you introduce. Points that are space-like separated with respect to G could be time-like separated with respect to your flat metric. That just might end up giving the wrong answer. Another approach you might consider is to try to sum over Lorentzian metrics on the world sheet, embedding them directly into the Lorentzian space-time. That seems sort of more natural in some sense, but technically it's rather challenging. It's known that you cannot put a non-singular Lorentzian metric on a manifold with non-zero Euler number. So in terms of the world sheet expansion that we're used to, almost all of the world sheets are going to require singular Lorentzian metrics. So what singularities do you allow? Even when the Euler number is zero, when we're talking about just the usual cylinder, there are many different types of Lorentz metrics. You can have black holes on the world sheet. That's a possible metric on the cylinder. Are those included? So basically, we just don't know what the rules are. In principle, the ADS-CFT correspondence answers this question of how to compute loop corrections to a background which involves gravitational waves scattering in an asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime. So there, at least, we have a proposal for what the right answer is. But I would argue that just changes the question, because in that context, we have to understand how does one recover a semi-classical spacetime from the dual conformal field theory? And I probably should have said from the dual conformal field theory and a particular choice of state, because it's clear that for some states, there just won't be a semi-classical spacetime description. But at least in the cases where there are, where we know we have some gravitational wave scattering in some nonlinear way in an asymptotically ADS spacetime, there's got to be some dual conformal field theory description of that. And it would be nice to know how you could go back, from the conformal field theory and reconstruct the spacetime approximately. Well, that was one topic, and as I have a few more minutes left, I'd like to speculate about another topic, which is, what is the fate of the closed-string tachyon? Over the past year and a half, we've made tremendous progress in understanding the open-string tachyon, largely through the work of Ashok Sen. And many people, I think, will be talking about that later in the session. But we can now ask, what is the analogous statement, or what is the result of the closed-string tachyon? So about 6 months ago, Lenny Susskind and I suggested that one way of understanding the closed-string tachyon, the tachyon in the closed bosonic string, was to think about a bosonic analog of M-theory. So this is a theory which would live in 27 dimensions, the idea being that in all the superstring theories, the dilaton was, or could be thought of geometrically, as the length of an extra direction. So why not for the bosonic string as well? The bosonic string has a dilaton. You can think of that as giving you the length of the 27th direction. And then one would postulate this 27-dimensional theory where the massless fields, just as for ordinary M theory, consist of just a metric and a four-form field strength. This theory would also have membranes, just like M theory, because of the four-form. It would have dual 21 brains instead of five brains. But one check of this is that if you write down the sort of simple action, the simplest action in 27 dimensions for G and F, and dimensionally reduce down, you can recover the bosonic string action and the relation between the 27-dimensional Planck length and the string length. I should say that you have to compactify not on a circle, but on the circle mod Z2, as Hirava and Witten did to get the heterotic string out of the ordinary M theory. But you can then compare the length of the circle, the length of this 27th dimensional interval to the Planck length, and find that, And what you find is that if you take one of these Planck tension membranes and stretch it in the extra dimension, that has precisely the tension you need for a fundamental string. So at least this simple check works. You can think of the ordinary strings as stretched membranes, just as we do in 11 dimensions. What does this have to do with the tachyon. Well, it's been known for 20 years that the ordinary Kaluza-Klein vacuum is unstable. This is what Witten showed in the early 80s. That means that if you take, well, let's go back to just five dimensions for a moment. So the spatial section of ordinary Kaluza-Klein theory vacuum is just R3 across a circle, just R3 across a circle. And that solution, Witten showed, could decay. And what it decays into is sort of pictured here. You take your R3, you cut a ball out of it with a radius of order R0, where R0 is the same scale as the size of the circle at infinity. Above each point here, you put a circle, and the circle shrinks as you come in, so that when the circle hits this sphere that you've removed, it shrinks smoothly to zero size. So the total space here has no boundary, but it roughly looks like R3 with a hole cut out. The probability for decay turns out to be e to the minus R0 divided by the Planck length cubed. So it's very small for big circles. And we consider, I mean, this is like toroidal compactification of string theory. This is just ordinary flat space with a circle. And we consider toroidal compactifications of string theory, ordinary superstring theory, all the time. You might ask why we don't worry about this. And the reason we don't have to worry about this is that if there are fermions in the theory, and you demand that the fermions are periodic going around the circle at infinity, which is the standard boundary conditions for supersymmetric vacua, then this instability is absent. In this background, the only fermions you can introduce are ones which are antiperiodic around the circle at infinity. But if we're talking about bosonic string theory, there are no fermions, and so we can't rule this out, and this instability will occur. In fact, it occurs not just for circle compactifications, but for circle mod Z2, as Fabinger and Harava pointed out in ordinary M theory. If you take your circle and you mod by Z2, it becomes a line interval. And then if you look at sort of the ends of this line interval, the sort of ends of the world in this picture, you find that what you tunnel to is this sort of wormhole where the two ends of the world are joined by one of these throats. Under subsequent evolution, this hole that you've cut out expands exponentially and eventually cuts off all of space. So this wormhole will then expand out after it's nucleated. Well, this picture, which is sort of described in terms of gravitational instantons, is only valid when the size of the circle or the size of the line interval at infinity is bigger than the Planck scale. The 26-dimensional bosonic string is supposed to be obtained when the length of the circle goes to zero. That's the usual weak coupling limit. So there are analogous situations, for example, in D-brain, anti-D-brain annihilation, where when the separation between the D-brains is bigger than the string scale, this instability occurs via nucleation of a wormhole. It's a non-perturbative effect. But when the separation between the D-brains goes to zero or becomes less than the string scale, you generate tachyons. The stretched strings are tachyonic, and you see this instability perturbatively. So similarly here, it's natural to postulate that the instability which we know exists when the separation is bigger than the Planck scale goes over into a tachyonic instability when the separation is less than the string scale, less than the Planck scale, I should say. But that's exactly what we see. That is the tachyon of the ordinary bosonic string. And so our suggestion is that the tachyon in the bosonic string is a remnant of this non-perturbative instability when R0 goes to zero. So let me just, how much time do I have? Okay, so now I can say just one more thing. In this sort of scenario, there is a natural analog of the ADS-CFT conjecture. The old version, the supersymmetric version, is of course that M theory with ADS-4 cross S7 boundary conditions is described by a 2 plus 1 conformal field theory with SO8 symmetry. In this bosonic version, this 27-dimensional theory with a 4-form in metric has a solution, which is ADS4 cross S23. This solution, well, there was some question about whether this solution would be stable. This is, of course, a non-supersymmetric theory. If you look at compactifications of the usual 10 and 11 dimensional supergravity theories, the known solutions which are stable of this form are almost always supersymmetric. The ADS4 cross S7, ADS5 cross S5, they're all supersymmetric vacua. And most of the other compactifications that you might think of, like ADS4 cross S3 cross S4, I guess, are unstable. So in a paper that came out just last month, Oliver DeWolf, Dan Friedman, Steve Gupser, and Steve's student Mitra and I studied the stability of this and more general things and found that in fact these vacua, ADS cross a sphere, are always stable to linearized perturbations of the supergravity. So these are stable solutions, and one might ask if there's a dual 2 plus 1 conformal field theory. Of course, now that you have SO24 symmetry on the supergravity side, you would expect an SO24 symmetry on the field theory. And one obvious question is, does such a theory exist? That would be very interesting to check. And so finally, I have now said that this instability that we see as a tachyon goes over its strong coupling into this non-perturbative instability. Since the rate for that goes to zero exponentially as the radius goes to, the length of the circle goes to infinity, we would expect 27-dimensional flat space to be stable in bosonic M theory. But you can ask, what about the fate of the theory at finite coupling or finite radius if you don't want to go all the way to infinite radius? And let me just end with maybe the most speculative thing I'm going to say, which is that it seems to me that the most likely endpoint is actually a state with zero metric. The idea is that condensing the open string tachyon got rid of all the open string states. Condensing the closed string tachyon should get rid of all the closed string states. You think of the space-time metric as like a brain for the closed string, much like the D brains are the brains for the open string. So condensing the closed string tachyon should, I think, give a state with zero metric. This is, in some sense, a topological phase of string theory. It's suggested by these nucleation of bubbles of nothing and also previous work in calculations of the closed string tachyon and in 2 plus 1 GR. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Gary. Other questions? Question for Tom.
Gary, in going back to the beginning,
yeah.
I didn't understand when you were describing the ratio of the minimal to maximal areas, why that couldn't have been a function of the length over R naught.
Okay, so let's assume that we start with a configuration where L is much bigger than R naught. Okay, so L comes in, first of all, in just setting boundary conditions, that certain fields have to be periodic with a scale L at infinity. If L is much bigger than R naught, I don't expect that to impose much of a constraint on the local dynamics. Then you could ask, well, what about the local dynamics? And I think that'll be governed by the sort of transition point between the stable and unstable modes. So you have all these perturbations or all these modes around, and we know that the modes with wavelengths less than R naught are stable, and the modes with wavelengths bigger than R naught are unstable. So R naught is setting the scale for what things are going to be stable and what's going to be unstable. And so I expect R naught to be the dominant parameter in fixing the final geometry.
Thank you.
Also coming back to the first part of the talk, when you were describing when two black holes were approaching each other, that there's actually an horizon forming away from the, a new horizon forming
right
outside. That shows at least that there can be that the location of the horizon can make discontinuous jumps.
Well, the event horizon doesn't make jumps.
Right.
The apparent horizon can
apparent
make jumps.
Apparent horizon
right
makes a jump. Could it be that sort of the in this again? I could turn time around, right? That the if I take these black holes that are sort of approaching each other. and actually send them at velocities in the other direction, then I could sort of let them.
Well, the black hole event horizon is not a time reversal quantity, right? It's defined very much in a time asymmetric way.
I understand, but I'm having a problem still with time reversal in this whole situation. That couldn't it be that the horizon that you're looking at that sort of has to take an infinite time of pinching off is not the eventual event horizon. It's indeed not the event horizon, but the apparent horizon.
Okay. The properties of the horizon I used, such as theta must be positive and it's a null and all of that, are properties of the true event horizon. Now, in the initial data, you might say, how do I know where the true event horizon is?
Because
it might be very different from what I thought.
Making assumption about the future.
But what I do know is where the apparent horizons are in the initial data, and I know the apparent horizons has this sort of S2 cross S1 sort of topology. And I know that the true event horizon must lie outside the apparent horizons. It must enclose all the apparent all the trap surfaces. It must lie outside the apparent horizon. So I know that the true event horizon that I want to start with is outside this and has the sort of at this and has the sort of S2 cross S1 topology initially.
Yeah. No, I still have a difficulty. At least if I would say take a black hole. In a periodic space, and then I make the radius of the periodic space smaller, then it will form a black string.
Yes.
And then I make it bigger again.
And then it doesn't go back to the black hole. That's correct.
So, but what's time reversal asymmetric? Can't I do this the other way around?
Because the event horizon is defined to be the boundary of the past of future null infinity. Okay, that's what introduces the time asymmetry in the problem.
Yeah, but that's just the definition. But the solution itself should have some. But okay, maybe we should talk about this later. But
okay.
The fact that the event horizon is outside the apparent horizon, don't you know that only if the event horizon doesn't pinch off?
No. You know that if, assuming there's no naked singularities outside the event horizon. Okay. So another consequence of this, which I haven't gone into, is that this evolution of the Gregory-Laflamme instability does not violate cosmic censorship. I confess, I had argued that this would be a good example of a violation of cosmic censorship in higher dimensional general relativity because it looked like you would perform these naked singularities under classical evolution. Well, you have a singularity only if you have incomplete geodesics, and the fact that the horizon generators are complete, the horizon doesn't pinch off in finite time, tells you you have no singularities on the horizon. So you don't produce the violations of cosmic censorship this way, and you can also set things up so that you're working basically in the domain of dependence of initial data, and you never have, in that space, naked singularities outside the horizon.
And to show completeness of these geodesics, you are not assuming cosmic censorship?
No. The argument that the horizon can't pinch off in finite time just used the Ray-Chaudhuri equation. I didn't have to use cosmic censorship.
Is it straightforward to see that you can replace the weak energy condition in the assumption of your theorem with something like the averaged weak energy condition? Is that obvious, or?
I know there's been various investigations over the past 10 years or more about which of the properties of which of the results which came out of the standard singularity theorems and properties of black holes in the late 60s and 70s could be replaced. With an averaged null energy condition as opposed to the weak energy condition. We haven't looked at that in detail, so I don't know offhand if this would all go through with an averaged energy condition. But we could check.
Let's thank Gary again.